Okay, let's get going. It's Mark Schenker on behalf of the Society of Addiction Psychology, and we're presenting our monthly clinical teleconference. Our speaker today is Bruce Leese, who is professor in several departments at the University of Kansas, has written several books on cognitive therapy of substance use disorders, and directs a clinic out there. Is it all substance use disorder clinic?
It's all addictions.
Okay, all addictions. Okay, good.
It's the University of Kansas Cochran Logan Center, made possible by a grant from people of the same name at the university.
Sounds great. Bruce was recently president of our division, so he knows what he's talking about. And a couple of quick announcements. If you bring up any clinical material, be aware that we can't protect confidentiality, and since we are recording, please be discreet. Please press your mute button, otherwise this thing gets very noisy. In August, we're having no call because it's the APA convention. September 13th, Marcel Bond Miller will be talking about medical cannabis, and on October 11th, Donald Michael. We're recording, and that's the story. So, Bruce, why don't you take it on.
Very good. All right. Well, it's a pleasure.
Blake Hilton.
I always enjoy doing these, and I thank everyone who's decided to join us. I thought I would bring to your attention that I'm going to be citing materials that are accessible to you at no financial charge and probably at very little labor expense. If you go to addictionpsychologist.org, you'll see that there's a library of materials there, and the materials that I'll be talking about today you can find in the library under diversity. So if you want to take a look at that, feel free, but again, addictionpsychologist.org. I've always had that website just to kind of make materials available to people I'm working with. So in the library, you just click on diversity, cultural differences, and stigma, and it'll take you down to some of the materials I've referenced today. Also under video and audio recordings, if you click on that, you'll find that under audio recordings, there's a link to the slides that we'll be talking about today. So I am delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be doing this, like I said earlier. If you take a look at the slides, I have them by page, two per page. So you can see on page one, that's who I am and how you can reach me, and I have no conflicts of interest relevant to this presentation. So I have already been introduced. Page two, you can see overview of conference call. Mark was so generous as to introduce me. I was going to ask people to answer these questions to make it more interactive as we've done in the past, but it sounds like there may be too many people on the line for you to introduce yourselves, which is kind of terrific since there are more than a dozen people on. So I am going to encourage you to keep your finger near the mute button, because it sounds like everyone is on mute, thank you, but if you want to jump on, make sure you hit the mute button and get off mute in order to jump on. I always like to start, I have pen in hand and would be willing to write down any questions that people have in advance, maybe based on looking at the slides or just the name of the presentation. Are there any questions you want to make sure I address before my 50 plus minutes are up? I'll give you a moment to get off mute if anybody has questions. Again, this is a talk on CBT for diverse patients who have diverse addictions. All right, save your questions if you have any and jump in as needed. I do want some of you to press your mute button and get off mute for a minute to tell me what your definition is of cultural diversity. And I know people like Robert would be happy to accommodate me, maybe Cindy, maybe Mark. what do you think we're talking about when we talk about diverse patients or diverse clients? Anyone on the line? Come on, press the mute button and say, by diverse, cultural diversity, I think you mean, and fill in the blank. Come on. There we go.
Yeah, it's Mark, and when I read the title, my assumption was not cultural diversity, but diversity of addiction.
It's both diverse patients or clients and. So we're going to be talking about diverse patients and diverse addictions. So,
well, this is Steve, and I'm assuming you're going to be using the APA definitions, which go not across ethnicities and alone, but also include ages and disabilities, for example, as well.
Thank you. Steve, thank you. That is exactly right. So we're talking about a group of people that we see that are different in terms of their age, their ethnicity, and Steve, what was the other one you mentioned? I'm not sure he heard me. So we're talking about people with many, many, many different backgrounds, many of which can be defined by various cultural labels. Let's just go down to what is CBT. That's the fourth slide on page two. So cognitive behavioral therapy, the way I think about it, is a set of approaches that are designed to help people with mental health problems. But what's become very apparent, at least in the 35 years that I've been doing cognitive behavioral therapy, it's now really a pretty substantial family of therapies that focus on changing thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and ultimately helping people to live life more fully and effectively. It still involves the development of skills, knowledge, and expertise, but it's a really substantial family now that includes people who practice acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, rational emotive behavior therapy, just straight cognitive therapy, behavioral activation, so forth and so on. So, any of you who are on the call who consider yourself cognitive behavioral therapists may actually see yourself as being most well-versed in one or two of these, some of you more well-versed in all of them. My preference over the course of my career has been to really look at the commonalities between them and really just think of CBT as a whole family of techniques that all pretty much it contain five essential components. And I'm going to talk about them. I talk about them at every opportunity because I think they are important for us as we conceptualize cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, it sounds like there's one person whose mute button is not pressed. I can hear a siren now. So if you are the person with the siren in the background, if you could just press your mute button, that would be great. And anyone else who might have their mute button unpressed. So as we think about CBT, and as we think about the fact that it really is about a family of different approaches to CBT, I find it really helpful to think about them all in terms of structure and collaboration and case conceptualization, psychoeducation, and structured techniques. So all cognitive behavioral therapies do emphasize their approaches as being relatively structured. That it's not free association where the client or the patient just sits and chats, that it's an approach that, because it's so psychoeducational, that requires a certain degree of organization and focus and again, structure. So that's the first essential component as I talk about cognitive behavioral therapy. Collaboration, a lot of people think of collaboration as just two people in therapy getting along well. But in cognitive behavioral therapies, it's much more than that. It's a process, regardless of which family member you are, behavioral activation or any of the others. It's much more of kind of a mutual agreement about what the goals are, and really a give and take, not just of getting to know each other and figuring out what the work is going to be, but also giving and getting feedback. In all good CBT, there's a process of saying, you know, what are you getting out of this? To what extent is this meeting your needs? What are you learning here? And you know, that follows a long tradition of assessment in cognitive and behavioral therapy. So structure and collaboration are two of the most essential components. My favorite is the one I refer to as the third, and that's case conceptualization. So case conceptualization, because it's consideration of all the different factors that play into a person's well-being, because it considers all of the factors, from my perspective, that's where most of my attention goes when I start thinking about diversity. As Steve mentioned earlier, when we talk about APA's definition of diversity, which is cross-cultural, cross-ages, cross-sexual orientations, you name it, you know, case conceptualization is nothing else works without conceptualizing people accurately and effectively. And that includes their intrapersonal processes, their interpersonal processes, how they develop, what environment they come from, what their socioeconomic background is, their education, distal and proximal factors, so forth and so on. So case conceptualization, by default, picks up a lot of what make people diverse. That entire list right there, if you're following along on the slides, it's the bottom of page 3. Two more essential components, psychoeducation and structured techniques. One of the biggest mistakes that were made when CBT was first being developed was that structured techniques were overemphasized. People heard about, you know, the techniques, daily thought records and advantage disadvantages analysis and downward arrow techniques and relaxation. They heard about all these cognitive and behavioral techniques and way overemphasized them, thinking that the goal of cognitive behavioral therapy was to fix people without adequate attention paid to the first four factors: structure, collaboration, case conceptualization. So I asked earlier what cultural diversity means. As was mentioned, it's a lot of what you see in any case conceptual, good case conceptualization, where you're trying to figure out, you know, who is this person sitting in front of me as I try to do therapy? Who are they? What are some of the distal antecedents or background experiences that make them who they are today, whether it's socioeconomic or the era in which they were born into, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it helps to acknowledge that there are groups that exist within our culture that, because of the nature of the group that the people are in, really impact how they think about and experience the world, and therefore how they manifest their problems as well as their resources, how they manifest both resources and problems. So really learning as much as you can about these groups and who they are and what they experience is obviously really important. You know, it's very, very important not just to think about other people's cultures, but to really hold your own up against others and say, really, what does make us different? Who am I, and how does my background really I'm this Jewish boy from New York who finds himself in Kansas City for 37 years, and even going from the East Coast to the Midwest provided me with quite the number of surprises because of the differences even within our own country in cultural backgrounds. Moving to a town of 550 people, where the nearest house was almost a mile away from being born and raised in New York and Long Island and Albany, quite a shock. So it's not just about who these people are, but who are you, and how has that impacted? Without that perspective, you are short on your ability to understand how you're experiencing people from different cultures. So I would ask you, again, there are a lot of people on the line, and I know people are reluctant to respond, particularly online, but I would have you at least think to yourself, what life experiences have you had that have impacted your thoughts about diversity? I just shared with you that I was born and raised on the East Coast in New York and happened to be Jewish and have found myself a number of times in the minority in various places I've been, and have also had experiences that involve diverse groups when I was younger that influenced how I view various diverse groups now. Without getting into too much detail, I would have you really think about what were the most significant things that have happened to you that influenced how you think about various groups. For example, LGBTQ, how many people have you known personally who have communicated with you, who aren't your patients, about what it means to be a lesbian or a lesbian woman, a gay man, bisexual, a transgender person? What has impacted you? How old are you, and how much experience have you had with people who are different ages? And have any of those people impacted you profoundly? Have you had mentors that were a different gender from you? Or have you had mentors that were a different race or ethnicity? And did it change the way you think? Have you had patients that have impacted you profoundly? Things you didn't know or stories that you didn't know you'd ever hear. I'm about to tell you a story from not very long ago. In fact, this is 100% true. I'm changing some demographics to protect the patient, but yesterday in my clinic, yesterday on July 11th, 2019, I found myself in a room with and again, I'm changing background information, so it might be a man or a woman. It might be a 60-year-old or a 55-year-old or a 70-year-old, and it might be somebody with disease A, and I might say disease B. But I found myself yesterday in a room with a woman who is 60 years old, who is African American. Again, I'm definitely not telling you the truth about every demographic intentionally. But this woman had canceled her appointment the week before and said to me, I can't make it to the appointment because I'm in a lot of pain. And she only gave me an hour's notice. And I explained to her, you know, we really need to drop you to the bottom of the cancellation list when you cancel same day because, you know, it's just part of our policy. And she said, well, I really, really have a lot of pain. I think I mentioned this, an African-American woman in her 60s-ish. And I said, that's fine. I have a cancellation next week. Why don't you come in and see me? So I was sitting in the room yesterday with her, and she holds out her hand, and she says, look at my hand. And one hand compared to the other looked like a water balloon. And she said, look at my knee. And she put her knees together, was wearing shorts, and one knee looked like a water balloon compared to the other. And I said to her, oh my God, these must really hurt. This pain you have must be pretty significant. This is crazy swelling. And she said, yeah, I can't get my doctor to give me the medicines I need to control the pain. My doctor just has limits. And I said, I know. I said, doctors are really trying to be careful so people don't overdose on opioids. And I hope that's all it is. And she said, well, I find it really suspicious that my sister, not really her sister, I assure you, but a different family member. My sister, around my age, has a physician, and he controls her pain really well. And I said, gee, I wonder what the difference is. I can't imagine. She said, well, I don't have any idea. And then she stops and she said, well, her doctor is black. He's African American. I wonder if that has anything to do with it. And this was yesterday, and I've been reading the literature on how healthcare professionals perceive people of color, particularly African Americans, as having literally thicker skin, a higher pain tolerance. If you look at the study that I put in the library that I told you about on addictionpsychologist.org, you'll see under cultural diversity an article by Hoffman, also an article by Wyatt, one of many that describes the profound biases that physicians have when treating people of color for pain. The assumption by many is that black people don't feel pain as acutely as white people. Now, this all falls on the heels of me saying, what life experiences have you had? It's slide on page 4 at the bottom. What life experiences have you had? I've been reading the literature for years literally, on how black people, African Americans, are perceived differently in the emergency department and by physicians when they come in describing pain. I had never seen it firsthand. The chills and goosebumps that went up and down my spine after learning about this from my patient of 2 visits just blew my mind, something I will never forget. Hopefully now that I've told you the story, you won't forget. It's a patient who is seeing a white physician who says, you know, I don't think you need as much pain medication as you think you need. Now, but I don't know the whole story. Maybe it's true, but these are people who are going to, not these being any particular group, but people will be coming to you from diverse backgrounds, and not only is it important for you to imagine what it's, what it's like to be them, because they are part of a diverse group that is a minority, but also how do other people who aren't you, who are clinicians, how are they treating these people? For example, people in the medical profession. And this is, we are a group of psychologists who treat people with addictions, and particularly with the with so much emphasis on opioid addiction, we're treating people with addictions that involve pain control. So this little known fact, or widely known fact, that people of color, particularly African Americans, are perceived as not either not having as much pain as they say, or being able to tolerate it more. This is really an issue that we need to be attentive to. So that was my life experience, and that was my way of introducing to you a real problem and something really important that has to do with our work as addiction psychologists, and understanding that when we're dealing with people with opioids, if they have the misfortune of being a person of color, it may be assumed that they're just diverting the drugs or abusing them. And there's probably more to the story. If you want the articles that I just cited, again, addictionpsychologist.org, go to the library on that website, and then go down to diversity, and you'll find the Wyatt or the Hoffman article, one of dozens and dozens of articles on the differences in how people are treated based on their ethnicity medically. So I'm going now to the slide on the top of page 5. What we should know as addiction psychologists is that tailoring services to the specific needs of ethnic groups will definitely improve utilization and outcomes. I have a group of veterans that say they've gone to all different kinds of treatment centers, but the fact that we have a group only for veterans makes a huge difference for them, because they are the group that I have said you know, it is so good to sit in the room with people who have been through the same thing, who understand my experience and know and understand what I need. As Steve was generous in pointing out, APA provides us with standards and guidelines for working with culturally diverse groups. Multicultural guidelines, they've been coming out for quite a while now. As you can see at the bottom of page 5, what you see at the bottom of page 5 is a picture of the various resources that are available from SAMHSA, from APA. APA has multicultural guidelines, ecological approach. They have guidelines for practice with transgender and gender nonconforming people. They have guidelines for psychological practice with LGB in 2012. So you can see a picture of all kinds of resources. I have posted them on the website I've been talking about if you want to just download them. There's no strings attached. just links. No strings, just links. Some of you may not know that the cultural formulation interview is part of DSM-5. It provides a framework for considering the effects of culture on every patient. So if you want to learn more about what we should know as addiction psychologists, these resources are quite good. The TIP 59, the SAMHSA TIP 59, Improving Cultural Competence, comes as a full-length, hundreds of pages document, but also a shortened version. And again, you can download that. So on the top of page 6, the slide on the top, we as addiction psychologists really need to know about disparities in mental health services for racial and ethnic and other minorities. You know, despite the fact that these people face barriers in the availability and accessibility and high quality care, there's still this big gap between research and practice, and that's particularly bad for people with racial and ethnic minorities. Fortunately, in research settings, people like the VA in many cases, people can get care that's evidence-based, but everyone on the call probably knows that there are a lot of private entities that provide care that don't have a lot of motivation to demand a certain amount of fidelity. But between clinicians not observing evidence-based practices for addictions and clinicians not addressing evidence-based practices for people who come from diverse minorities, it's like a double whammy. It's like a bad statistical interaction effect of you don't get the evidence-based practice, and furthermore, whatever you get isn't culturally sensitive. And again, if you want to know what I mean by culturally sensitive, I've provided you with a list and even pictures of various resources. So what we really need to know, page 7, and you can find this, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants who have done a lot of work in this area by pointing out to you that, you know, that some of the examples of differences between cultures, we are, as a society, you know, we don't have Americans don't generally have like a holistic world view. We tend to be a pretty materialistic society rather than holistic. It's important to look at differences between things like that and differences in spirituality. We're going to be posting soon another clinical pearl on the Division 50 SOAP website on 12-step programs. And one of the things I read in one of these resources that's outstanding on dealing with diverse cultures is so many cultures, millions and millions and millions, billions of people in this world, many of whom happen to be in our country, don't have a Judeo-Christian view of existence and reality. And the Lord's Prayer said at a meeting could really be troubling if we're sending people, as we send people to mutual help meetings, whether it's Smart Recovery or AA or whatever it is, our own awareness of whether or not part of the orientation might conflict with the person's cultural background. It's pretty important. So even in our processes of making referrals, we need to be thinking, you know, what is this person's cultural background, and to what extent will what they bring with them as a human being, to what extent will that be a good fit with this place that I'm referring them to? So, you know, there are differences between cultures, but also these, a lot of these differences affect the therapeutic relationship. You know, in our hospital, a university medical center, there are psychologists that wear white coats. And I don't happen to, but, you know, there are boundary and authority issues that some people experience when they come from cultures that already mistrust or already overtrust people in authority, mistrust or the opposite direction. So being aware of the impact. We have a big Sudanese population that comes to our clinic for care, for medical care. And, you know, this group, even eye contact, is the view of eye contact between Caucasian Americans and people from some other cultures. And just understanding how a person's different culture impacts how they will relate to you is really important. There's an exercise I would like to do when I have 7 hours and I. When I have 7 hours, you can see at the bottom of page 7, it says exercise. when I have 7 hours and I'm doing a full-day workshop on diversity, or even 4 hours, I will make this a more extended exercise, but I'm going to make it a brief exercise here. I'm hoping that of the whatever number of people is on the line. By the way, Mark said that there was one presenter who was cut off and never knew it and talked for the full hour and nobody knew. Mark, can you confirm that I'm still talking to people? Everyone's being so polite and quiet.
Mark, I can hear you.
All right, good deal. I want you to do a little exercise with me. I don't know how many people have the slides, but I want you to go down to slide, the first slide on page 18. It says photo number 1. I want you to look at that smiling human being in photo number 1. And I want you to ask yourself and then answer it silently. I want you to ask yourself, what are my first thoughts, my automatic thoughts when I see this man? What's the first thing that pops into my mind? The very first. Okay? And then I want you to ask yourself the question of photo number 1, what is the first thing that pops into his mind when he sees me as his provider, as an addiction psychologist? What is the first thing you think when you see him, and what's the first thing he thinks when he sees you? You hold out your hand, you shake his hand, he shakes yours. What's going through his head? What's going through your head? All right. I hope you've all done that. I hope you all have the slide. Now I want you to go to photo number 2. I've never done this in a blind telephone audio-only conference call, so I want feedback at the end. Go to photo number 2 on the bottom of page 18. You encounter these people in your waiting room for whatever reason, and what goes through your mind? Photo number 2, what's the first automatic thing that goes through your mind, and what goes through their mind when they see you as the doctoral level, I assume most of you, if not all of you, students, master's level. What goes through your mind when you see these people sitting in your waiting room, and what do they think when they see you? Let's look at photo number 3. You're coming into your office to start your day, and you notice that there's this couple standing outside, and it turns out this is a couple that one of them is coming to see you about their psychological concerns. What goes through your head when you look at photo number 3 on the top of page 19? And when they notice you're looking at them, what goes through their mind when they look at you? How about photo number 4 at the bottom of page 19? You see this man, photo number 4, in your waiting room. You go out to greet him. He's your new patient. What do you think when you see this man? What's the first thing that goes through your mind? And what's the first thing that goes through his mind when he meets you and shakes your hand? He's about to see you for therapy. How about the person in photo 5? What goes through your mind? What goes through this person's mind? Photo 5. Photo 6. We'll go faster now. Some of you don't have the photos. Photo 7. How about photo 8? It's the guy in the hat. What's the first thing that goes through your mind when you see this person? And he looks at you, and what's going through his mind? And then finally, photos 9 and 10. Photos 9 and 10. Now, I do want somebody or a few somebodies who are courageous enough, who have the photos in front of them. This has been a really, really fun part of when I do this workshop live. Again, I don't generally do it on the phone. What were some of your thoughts for any of those pictures, and what do you think their thoughts were about you, and what do you think the point is in this exercise? And I am going to be quiet till I get some takers on this. Press your mute button and hop on.
Hello, this is Robert. I'll go first.
Thank you. Speak up, Robert. I'm so glad you're even on the call. Robert's on our outreach committee on Division 50. So I
found it really interesting because I was thinking about the first few slides. With the African-American, the first one, slide number 1, responded, yes. Like I thought, my first reaction was distinguished man. And then my next, and maybe it's because of what we already said, is, oh, no, a white therapist. And it was interesting to me that on the second and third photos, my response categorized more in terms of, like, my second response was, these are Muslim people. My initial reaction, Muslim. And theirs was that they may view me as dangerous.
Thank you.
And then with the third photo, again, it was immediately lesbian, which isn't necessarily the case, of course, but that was my response. And again, will he be able to understand me? So, but what fascinated me, and then, on the fourth photo, the African American man, I thought down and out, and I hope this guy can help me. So, but what interests me was the African Americans. I categorized not by race or ethnicity so much as the characteristics of the photo. Whereas with the Muslims, it was that second one was religion, the third one was sexual preference. So, those are some of my responses.
Thank you so much. I knew you would hop in and help out with some part of it. Anybody else?
Hi. One of my first thoughts in most of the slides now was like how different this person's life is from mine.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And my feeling like, well, I can probably relate to them, but are they going to trust me? They can look at me and say, here's another guy who's been to school, white guy who's been to school.
Very good. Thank you. Just because there's so much material, I'll give one more person a chance to jump in if they're interested in doing so. Um, you know, it's interesting, Mark, after you say that, I'm sure I chose these pictures. I was looking for pictures of people who are different from me, and, you know, that was my way of choosing them. So.
Yeah, this is Steve. One of my reactions I noticed, and maybe this reflects my history as an academic, is, wow, this is going to be interesting.
And, yeah.
Part of what I mean by that is I feel I learn so much from my clients, and the danger there is they're not there to just teach me; they're there to get something from me. But I really do feel that I learn so much from them, and this is going to be, like as I said, really interesting.
Thank you. I love that. Well, then. If any of the rest of you had these kinds of experiences, you went through the exercise, then it was well worth it, and I appreciate it. And I apologize to anyone who, for any reason, didn't have the slides handy. It could have been that you got them and you just weren't able to carry them to this phone conference call. Let's move on. I'm going to now talk about implicit bias in a way that you may not have heard it before. I'm going to start out by saying implicit bias has a bad
name.
Implicit bias is having thoughts beyond your awareness that influence how you act and feel. But, implicit bias is necessary for human functioning. Typically implicit bias is construed as a bad thing, and therefore it's stigmatized. And a result of that stigma, a lot of people deny their own implicit biases. And, you know, it's interesting, compassionate liberals like therapists are at the greatest risk for denying that we have implicit bias. You know, we want to run from it like we're on fire. And, it's necessary to have it, and I won't try to give you details or specifics about how your implicit bias would serve you well, but you know, there's potential for implicit bias to be life-saving if it causes you to avoid something that you could really get in trouble with. You can't de-bias yourself. You can't get rid of your biases. You can become conscious of them and address them, which brings me to my favorite topic in the world, the next slide, System 1 and System 2 Thinking. Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize, a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics years ago, turned his ideas into a very dense text called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. It's worth reading and spending time with. System 1 thinking is intuitive and fast and automatic and effortless. It's implicit. It's like implicit bias. It's emotional. It's efficient. You know, for us to know how to take a shower in the morning and how to brush our teeth and how to walk out the door and take a cab, an Uber, a subway, a bus, our car to work, it's all System 1. Most of our lives are in System 1. And I don't have unconscious in there, but it's unconscious thinking. It's versus System 2, which is slower and effortful and kind of lazy. It likes to sleep a lot. But an exercise like the one we just did was to try to get all of you and me included aware of our System 1 thinking, that automatic thinking, so that if there's anything automatic that may cause us to make mistakes, we use System 2, much more deliberate, a word I haven't put in there, to make sense of things. Steve mentioned that as an academic or scholar, you know, he's hoping to learn from everyone, as I am, and it takes System 2 to learn. System 1 exists so that we don't have to learn everything over and over and over again, like which key starts our car or gets us into our house. So again, as we look at, I'm moving on with slides, at the five essential components of cognitive and behavioral therapy, again, I'm brought back to case conceptualization as my favorite, number 3. And so I want to talk about case conceptualization as our best means of making sense of the diversity of people with addictions and the addictions themselves. So real simple questions for the case conceptualization. And regardless of whether you're a behavior analyst or a behavioral activation expert or acceptance and commitment therapy, and I could go on, whoever you are in that family of cognitive behavioral therapists, you want to know, who is this person? Who are you of those 10 pictures? Who are you really beyond my system one thinking? How do you define your problem? How do you think I can help? These should now look a little more familiar. You know, I ask you, what's your automatic thought? Who are you in that picture? And how do you think I can help? Well, what do you think I'm here for? How have you tried to solve this problem from your own perspective, which is influenced by your culture? What's working, what hasn't, what barriers might be in the way? Your case conceptualization reflects as much about you as it does the patient. I'm on bottom of page 10. And it means that you can only see the world through your own lens. You can be empathetic, but you can't erase who you are. You're going to have implicit biases. They will operate as system one. And you have to check them. You have to check them at the door and leave them there. But you have to check them as you have the encounter and you're delivering your cognitive behavioral therapies. Now, as you can see at the top of page 11, the cognitive behavioral model, the most basic one, is that, there are triggers and people have thoughts, and that and the consequence is that they do or don't do their addictive behaviors. So that's the basic CBT model. At the top of page 11. At the bottom, you see more, and I show you these. These are what I've spent my whole career focusing on, kind of models for understanding addictions. This is more of the vicious cycle of triggers and those activating addiction-related thoughts and permissive thoughts and urges and cravings. It's the vicious cycle we are all familiar with. But I'm particularly interested, if you look at the top of page 12, in the developmental part of the model of cognitive behavioral understanding of addiction. Our early life experiences, which are distal antecedents, impact or cause us to develop the way we think, feel, and act, and exposure and experimentation with various behaviors, including addictive behaviors, determine whether we continue that. And at the top and bottom of page 12, we are just a big old ball of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Some are advantageous to our causes and some aren't. And our culture largely determines, our early and distal experiences determine whether we will be interested in gambling, cigarettes, alcohol. Many, if not most, addictive behaviors at least are initiated early in life, for most of us, but distal. But let's now go to the top of page 13, the developmental model. So there's a picture of how early life experiences not only influence our learned thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, but also influence the cues and the stimuli, internal and external, that become the vicious cycle of addiction. So again, I will thank anyone who participates. I will thank them greatly and frequently. Steve, as well as I know this model at the top of page 13, this developmental model from the distal antecedents that impact people and the exposure to addictive behaviors, and then the cycle that maintains that addiction, every single person teaches me something new that I didn't know. So now we can pull in stress, which is inevitable in the life of somebody who's part of one of these diverse groups. Stress is an important trigger, and you can, again, if you put together the top of page 13, triggers, cues, and stimuli, And then you understand that stress is an important trigger. You can really start to understand how not just general life stressors at the top of page 14 or catastrophic events or childhood maltreatment, but minority stress, whether it's racial, ethnic, sexual, or female identity. They cause stress, which can be part of the vicious cycle of addiction. So collecting data on to conceptualize each individual, tying together their distal, proximal circumstances, their high-risk situations. If you are culturally aware, your case conceptualization will be so much richer. And that doesn't mean if their skin color is different or if they have 200 piercings on their face and tattoos. It also means if they were raised wealthy versus not wealthy. So attending to content and process. The process that is important cognitively includes process includes that system one, system two thinking, how people think. So then you tie into that goals of therapy. You know, goals vary widely within and between people, and to some extent, culture will impact. Again, diverse addictive behaviors, there's so much data now to support the idea that not only chemicals are addictive. If you look at the fMRI studies of the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental activity in midbrain versus prefrontal cortex, and you see that exposure to gambling cues and sex cues and cocaine cues, it's a lot of similarities, not just in the self-reports of people who have addictions, but also in brain functioning and understanding that these diverse the many, many diverse addictions and the many, many diverse persons that have addictions really require us to be sensitive to all the processes I've talked about so far. So for some people, structure is really important and really helps them in therapy, having a nice agenda and bridging from where they were before and prioritizing and all that stuff. But for other people, it doesn't work. But there are a lot of cognitive and behavioral strategies that are available to us as cognitive behavioral therapists. And, you know, some people just respond better and their circumstances are more conducive to some cognitive behavioral strategies than others. So some people, acceptance and commitment or just acceptance is going to be more important than anything else. So I'm about to wrap up, as you can see. You know, there are lots of specific techniques, and the techniques should follow, and the strategy should follow your case conceptualization, which should include cultural factors. Those are distal and proximal antecedents to what influences people's interactions with addictive behaviors. And homework is necessary, but it's a loaded concept for a lot of people. People who have not had really positive experiences with education are not gonna say, "Wow, you're giving me homework. I'm really happy." And yet, it's such a part. People don't get resolution of their addictive behaviors from their 45 to 55 minutes with you a week if you're doing outpatient therapy, or even 28 days in a treatment center. It's what they do when they get home, and being aware of what environment they step into is going to be important. So you see, we're done with the slides. We're at page 17, and we have the only stuff that's left are pictures. So now I am with a whole five-ish minutes left. I'm happy to get any feedback or questions or anything else, and I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm done. It's your turn, everyone, anyone. Mark, it's awfully quiet. Did I lose everyone?
Well, you didn't lose me. I've been
Hello.
Paying attention. Yep.
This is Robert Schwabel.
Hello.
Bruce, that was a fantastic presentation. Thank you. And
oh, okay.
I have a I have a question I've been thinking about and didn't plan on asking, and it's but it kind of fits with what we're talking about. I've worked with people in organizations that are dealing with a lot of youth in the juvenile justice system, and I've thought about, you know, the fact there's such racial disparity, and so many people are sent to juvenile justice facilities that if they had been white and privileged, they might have had it resolved through a therapist at home or go to a treatment school or whatever, and they end up incarcerated. And I've been wondering your thoughts about, you know, and I've been toying with this and kind of thinking about it. How do we bring it up? I don't think it should go unspoken, you know, when people are there and they're, you know, conceivably very angry about being there and feeling that it's not fair, that they're not being treated properly. Somehow I think it's incumbent on us to bring up the issue of racial disparity and to even say, you know, there's a great likelihood you wouldn't even be here if you came from a different circumstance. And I'm wondering just your thoughts about how to address such an issue.
Well, one of the things that I propose here, and it's consistent with what APA is encouraging, is that actually SAMHSA, I believe that Big Fat SAMHSA tip focuses largely on institutions and trying to influence your own institution. We have a lot of posters and stuff in one of our clinics that says to anyone who sits down there that all people are equal. We have the rainbow flag. We have all kinds of stuff that so institutionally there needs to be changes, but also on an individual level, depending on, after I conceptualize somebody, I will be more or less direct. You know, if I want to be indirect, I'll just say, well, just tell me all the factors that you think have influenced you and gotten you to be at this point. Anything in your community, anything. And to what extent do you feel free to make your own decisions in this world is another question I'll ask. And another way I get around it is to say, you know, what is your goal? How were you taught to accomplish? What are the goals you have for your entire life or your value? And they should be based on your values. And to what extent, what strategies have you learned in order to achieve those? Robert, thank you for that great question. I hope I've answered that. Out of respect for the clock, I will thank you, Robert, for your kind comment about the presentation. I want to thank everyone else who is on the call. And Mark?
Yeah, and as the host, I want to thank you and tell you I also thought it was a really wonderful presentation and very thought-provoking for me. You know, whenever I hear you talk about CBT, I'm reminded of how diverse it is and how wide-ranging it is, because it was not the primary modality I was taught. So you always give me a deeper appreciation for it. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. I have a 1 o'clock meeting that I'm going to rush off to. Thank you for anyone who's left on the call. Mark, thanks for recording it. It'll be nice to I'll enjoy. I'd love to hear my presentation. I might learn something from it.
Thank you very much. It really was an outstanding presentation. I really appreciate it. And I really need to think and absorb what you presented.
Thank you. Who is this?
This is Diana Kenny.
Hi, Diana. Thank you. Hey, Mark, maybe we can make this a continuing education program.
I'm in favor of that.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.